I would like to introduce tonight's speaker, who is Mick. Mick, if you don't mind coming up here and talking to us. Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Mick Maher. I'm an addict and alcoholic. If you cannot hear me, turn up your hearing aids or come forward out of inventory row and you'll be fine. My sobriety, what can I tell you? That's where I spent my first year of sobriety, unmarred by a day of growth, right back there in the inventory row. My sobriety date, for anybody who cares about this stuff, is August 22nd, 1973. So for those of you who are not mathematicians, that's 52 years. I wish I could take credit, but God takes care of fools and drunks, so I'm really well qualified. I've been told that we are, oh, by the way, just a little historical perspective there. I got sober before light beer existed. How's that for useless tidbit of information? I've been told that they're recording tonight. I don't know how sensitive the microphone is, but if you're worried about your anonymity, please just laugh with an accent, and then you'll be fine. I've been asked to share, you know, my experience, strength, and hope tonight, and I love doing that. Like I said, I got sober in 1973. I was a 20-year-old Marine in the middle of the Vietnam War. So I love it when people tell me, oh, my God, you don't know how hard it is. Son, I was getting shot at. You buck up. And I understand that it's hard. I really do. For all of us, because we all have our own issues and agendas and everything else that goes with that. So what I'm going to do tonight is talk about my reading, how I read the big book, what it means to me, share with you the steps and how I went through them, or most of them anyway, and talk about the benefits that I've gotten out of being a sober member of AA. I did not have a choice. I was in the Marine Corps. I was actually a drill instructor over here at MCRD San Diego, and I came out of a blackout sitting across the desk from a Navy psychiatrist. I was 20 years old. I will tell you, it is very awkward to try and explain to somebody when you don't remember why you were there, how long you had been there, or what it is you had actually been saying while you were there. And I mean, in retrospect, I mean, Helen Keller could have seen the diagnosis. He certainly could have smelled it on me, because I was really bad. I was blackout drunk. And so he looked at me and said, you know, Sergeant, I'm going to give you a choice. Marine Corps doesn't give a lot of choices, but this guy's Navy, so maybe he's different. I said, what are my choices? He said, you can go to jail for about 5 years, or you can go to treatment. I was 20 years old. I had to think about that. And the quality of my thinking at the time was, I'm going to go to treatment because it'll be easier to drink in treatment. And that's how I got into treatment. But back up a little bit. I started drinking at 12 years old. I've heard people say, I was a drunk from the moment I picked up the first drink. I don't know that I was alcoholic then, but I can guarantee you there wasn't a hell of a lot of social drinking going on with 12-year-olds. And the way I got away with drinking back then was kind of simple. My mother, who was also alcoholic, had a great deal of dollars and no sense, and she was very much afraid of getting arrested for drunk driving. So she bought a limousine and hired a chauffeur, as you would. And so my sister and I would get driven to school in the back of a limousine that had a bar in it. And I'm sitting there in fifth grade, you know, this new math, they're putting numbers and letters together. I had enough trouble when it was just numbers. Now they're mixing in letters. I wanted to kill somebody. And so what happened is the chauffeur never ratted me out. And my mother never paid attention to how much booze was in the car because the chauffeur just did all the work of putting it in there, which was very nice. But unfortunately for my mother, she failed to manage the money she had, and the chauffeur and the car all went away, and we moved a lot. About every 6 months, I learned a lot about geographic cures. By the time I was 16, I was running wild in the streets of Chicago with some friends. My sisters had all been taken out of the house because of my mother's alcoholism. I was drunk every chance I could be. And It was great. I just thought I was living the life I was meant to lead. And so what ended up happening is I got taken away and sent to live with an uncle up in Minnesota. And he becomes a part of my story in a little bit. I'll tell you about him. And I went to live with him. Now, he had 12 children. Yeah, we're Irish Catholic, you know. No TV, exactly, you know. What's that great Groucho Marx line? You know, I like a good cigar, but I take that out of my mouth once in a while. So I'm sitting there now moving in with my uncle, who's got 12 children, and my older sister was living there. My uncle was a very, very successful businessman, also alcoholic. We're Irish Catholic, I suppose. CIA, you know, Catholic Irish alcoholic. It's just the way we are. And so I got put into a Catholic military academy because they were going to straighten me out. And the first thing I did is I found a drinking buddy. And my buddy's father owned this big, beautiful, fancy restaurant in a little town called Bloomington, Minnesota. And we had an unlimited supply of booze to steal from their basement. And that's what we did. And we drank like crazy people. And one day I was in class with a really bad hangover. And the teacher came up to me and accused me of cheating. I have a 142 IQ. I don't need to cheat. All I have to do is look at the book. And about 5 seconds later, I got it. But he didn't believe me, so he tried to hit me. He's a little, this is back in the, you know, 60s when they could get away with that. He tried to slap me. I blocked it. I'd been running wild in the streets of Chicago. I knew how to fight. That infuriated the little darling. So he took another swing at me with the other hand. I blocked that one. He did not get a third shot. When he came to, he was lying on the floor, nose broken, blood everywhere. Needless to say, I was not popular at St. Thomas Academy in Mendota Heights, Minnesota, so much so that they invited me to leave. Went back to my uncle's house to pack my trash. He was mad. He was drunk. We had a fist fight. I'm not sure which one of us won because we were both kind of drunk by that point. And I went to live with a different uncle down in the Chicago area. And it was becoming pretty apparent that I was in danger of becoming a professional junior in high school. Because apparently there's expectations in life. Like, show up. Be sober when you get here. It's like, oh, no, no. You get one or the other. You ain't getting both here. Not happening. So what happened is I went to live with him. And in the summer of 1970, I decided what I needed to do was join the Marine Corps. I don't know why I picked the Marine Corps. Everybody in my family had served in the Army. I decided the Marine Corps. Now, as I look back at that, I will point out that I was never really good with details, but there was a war going on, and I missed that detail. I'm not sure how. But I went off, joined the Marine Corps, and was running wild. And I was very good at what I did when I did it. And I got promoted very quickly. I made sergeant, which is an E5. It's a fairly good rank. I made it in 2 years. Not a lot of guys do that, but I did. But then I drank my way out of 2 commissioning programs. And I wanted to be a Marine Corps officer more than anything. But I just left it off. It wasn't my fault. It was their fault. It's always somebody else's fault in my world. So what ended up happening is I went to the drill field instead, and this kid, they're called fire watches, was walking fire watch one night, and I walked back. I had been drinking at the Anchor Inn up on San Diego Avenue. It's long gone now. It used to be a drill instructor hangout. And this kid did his job. He challenged me. Big mistake. I should never have been there. And he spent 3 weeks in the hospital. I beat him so badly. But I didn't know it because I was in a blackout. And so the doc looked at me and said, you can go to jail, and he had to explain why, because I really did not know why, or I can go to treatment. And I opted to go to treatment. He said, okay, we're going to send you back to Great Lakes. It's in Illinois. And we're going to send you back there to go to treatment because it's near your family, and everybody knows alcoholism is a family disease. And I'm smiling because, yeah, they're all drinkers. So that sounds like a plan. But I was 20, and I had to prove that I wasn't that bad yet. Again, a detail. I don't know how bad I wanted to get, but I wasn't that bad yet. So I went out to prove that I was not an alcoholic, not that bad yet. And that very first night of proof, I got arrested for drunk driving. Blood alcohol level of a 0.26. Yeah, that's the Richter scale for you. And I thought, okay, I missed the mark this time, but I'm going to be more careful going forward. And I sat around the barracks feeling sorry for myself because I did that really well. And then a few days later, I had it figured out. This time, I won't drink as much. Why didn't I think of that before? You know, damn details. So I got arrested for drunk driving. And this time, I was so drunk that I passed out during the breath test. And I somehow, in my mind, thought that was just clever. They can't prove I'm drunk. And I found out in the law of California, they don't have to. They call it a wet reckless. My insurance was the same, exorbitant after that. And the judge fined me. He didn't seem to care that I was a Marine. My attorney thought it was funny because he got to make a lot of extra money. And I had lost my driver's license for a span of 6 months. And I'm thinking, okay, this isn't really the way I had envisioned my life going. And I got called into this guy's office, this old Marine, and he looked at me and said, we don't think you're going to live long enough to get to Great Lakes. So they sent me over here to Balboa Hospital, the alcohol rehab unit. I went in on a Monday morning to meet the staff, and the guy looked at me, and I was the only Marine there. There were 16 sailors and me. And these guys, I mean, I want to tell you, these folks were antiques. They were like 35, 40 years old. God, they were old. And they all had pot bellies, you know, and they'd say things like, if you want what I have, it's like, you know, God, no, I don't want that. I don't even know what it is, but I don't want that. So the guy that was doing the interview said, tell you what we're going to do. We're going to give you these little white pills that'll help you to stay sober until we can admit you on Wednesday. Well, yeah, it was an abuse. That's cruel. I'd been an old field Marine, and the Navy corpsman used to give us white crosses, speed, so we could stay up late and, you know, while we're out on patrols. Well, it made perfect sense to me. The problem was, I was a little different than some of the guys I hung out with. They'd take it so they could stay awake. I, on the other hand, would pocket it. So when I could get back to the base or wherever we had a club or whatever, I could take the upper, whee, and then drink the downer, whoo, and somehow come out normal. A detail, but I was trying to avoid being normal, and it never really worked anyway. When I found out it was antabuse, I told him, I don't need no antabuse. You know, I'm fine. I can control it. So I went back to the barracks. I'd been kicked off the drill field. It's kind of the equivalent of having the old, see those old cavalry movies where they chop off their buttons or something. That's what it felt like. And on Tuesday night, the next night, I had 90 cents in my pocket. So I went to the bowling alley at MCRD, the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, San Diego. 90 cents in my pocket, and a bottle of Budweiser was 45 cents. And I had two bottles of Budweiser, thereby expending every dime to my name I wasn't going to get paid for another week and a half. And I stood up and I said, see, I can quit drinking anytime I want to. And August 21st, 1973, the last time I drank. The next morning, I checked into this Navy Alcoholism Treatment Center, and oh, man, I hated it. I was doing everything I could to drive those poor SOBs crazy. And by the way, I was very good at that. That first night, they took us to what was called the San Diego Central AA meeting. That was down at the War Memorial Building down in Balboa Park on Wednesday nights. And I walked in, and I sat in the way back in inventory row, and all these people would walk into the kitchen, and they'd get coffee and cookies and cake, and they'd come walking back out. And I'm trying to figure out how to scam coffee at an AA meeting. For those of you who are new, coffee's free. If you got a buck to throw in the kitty, do it. But if you don't, coffee is free. And I didn't know that. And I thought my life, as I understood it, was over. So I want you to know, if you're there tonight, if you are a survivor of the relapse wars, we are so glad you're back. because I can guarantee you, you wouldn't be back if it had been better out there, and all of us, no matter how long we've been sober, appreciate the fact that you did come back. And that's important. Now, for some of you, you could be like me. I never drank again. My first AA meeting was that Wednesday night, the 22nd, and I've not had a drink since then. No drugs, no booze, nothing. There is no 14th step in AA that says you have to relapse. And I, one of my little pet peeves, I go to meetings, people say, well, it's part of the program. No, it's not. It's part of the sickness. By the way, if you don't know what the 13th step is, just check with some of the women around you. They will tell you. So let me talk about sobriety, because I got to tell you, that's a hell of a lot more interesting than my pathetic little drinking career. I did try my best to drink, but I wasn't very good at it, obviously, or I wouldn't be here tonight. So I got when I got into this treatment center, I hated everybody and everything. It saved time. It's just a lot easier that way. And there was this crazy old Navy chaplain that used to come to do a talk for us. The guy's name is Jim W. And Jim had a couple of years of sobriety, and he was a chaplain. Now, I'm a recovering Catholic. I'd given up bingo and knee pads years and years ago. And I did not want anything to do with this clergyman. And he just kind of glommed onto me. I swear to God, I've never seen anything like it. I thought maybe, you know. But it turns out he was just a nice guy trying to be helpful. And what he also did that was incredibly brilliant is he never once told me what I had to do in AA. He made a lot of really sound suggestions. So I want to talk about the very first suggestion Jim ever gave me. That notebook right there that says South Bay Pioneers, three-ring binder. Jim handed me one of those with a bunch of empty sheets of paper in there. And he handed me a ballpoint pen. And he said, I'm going to suggest that you write your first step in detail. Now, there are all those fancy books out there telling you how to do it. Jim suggested I do it his way, and I did. And the detail was I had to start about what happened before I went drinking, what was I thinking, what happened while I was drinking, what were the consequences after that, and what allowed me to think I could drink again. And I was, you know, 20 years old, so I was a smartass. And I looked at him and I said, well, you know, I'm a blackout drinker. I really don't remember much. He said, that's okay. I'll help you get started. You have two tattoos you don't remember getting. God, I hated that man. So I start writing out about the first tattoo I get. When I was a kid, I was about 14. We all decided we needed to have our names tattooed on our arms. My name is Mick. It's four letters. It's not a complex name. They misspelled it. And as I'm writing this into my first step, I'm thinking, oh, this isn't pretty. And because I had to keep talking about what happened next. What happened next is I woke up the next morning, realized they misspelled the name Mick, all four letters of it. By the way, they left off the K. They didn't substitute a D. Some people wondered about that before. So I clarify that. So what happened is I had to get some India ink, a needle and a thread, and put the K on myself with a hangover. And it's crooked. So anytime I shower, I can see, oh, Lord. So my first step's right there on my arm. My second tattoo, kind of the same thing. I was drinking in L.A. We always call it a party. We're going to party. So I was drinking in L.A. with this party with my friends, guys I was stationed with. And as we were out there partying, I don't know what happened next. What I do know is I woke up in a hotel room. And this is back when you could smoke in a hotel. So I'm going to leave part of the story out because this isn't my fifth step. I went ahead and I reached out to get my cigarettes off the nightstand. And the match is out of the ashtray. And I'm looking at it as I'm lighting my cigarette, and it says, U.S. Grant Hotel. That's downtown San Diego. I was drinking in Los Angeles. No idea how I got there. Not a clue. And while I was doing that, I noticed there's a bandage that went from my wrist all the way to my elbow, filled with blood. And my first thought is, oh, my God, I've put my arm through a window. And then I peel back the bandage, and there's this massive tattoo dagger thing looking and says, death before dishonor, USMC. Oh, God. What a schmuck. So I put the bandage back, and I thought, oh, God, I wish I'd put my arm through a window. And then one of my drinking buddies knocks on the door of the hotel room, and he's just having a great, he gets his tiny little devil put on his shoulder. I could have killed the SOB. But I'm writing. Nobody made me get that tattoo. That was my doing. And by the time I got back to the base, I was talking about all the partying we had done, the girl that I had met, the drinking, it was fun. I got this tattoo that was really cool. Now, that's kind of the way my first step shook out. I would write item after item after item in great detail. Now, I was talking to a kid the other day at a meeting. He was already on the, 13th step. And he'd done his first step in one day. And I'm fascinated by that because it took me a year. Now, that's not to say one day isn't enough. For some people, it may be. But for me, it sure wouldn't have been. And it took me a year to write that out. And Jim suggested that I carry that notebook with me. And it was full. And I carried that notebook for 20 years. And it was incredibly detailed, incredibly painful to look at. And Jim used to say, because I like to think I'm intelligent, he'd say things like, here's the thing. Anytime you have one of those really creative thoughts that you're not that bad or this time will be different, open that notebook, any page you'd like, and see what it says. And find in there where you actually controlled your drinking. I carried that notebook for 20 years. I did look at times, never once found it. I had, about that time, I was going through some real serious emotional crises. Nowadays, we'd call it PTSD at the time. Everybody just thought I was a knucklehead. And what had happened is I'd had a bad day at work when I was in the Marine Corps. And this Navy corpsman had come and gotten me and put me on a helicopter, medevaced me. And I was paralyzed from the waist down. By the way, I'm doing much better now. And so I got medevaced, and I spent 6 weeks in the hospital, paralyzed from the waist down for the first week. After that, I got my legs back, which I was grateful for. And that corpsman, this was back when I was drinking, that corpsman was my best friend, and he got all the free booze he ever wanted from me. So one day, I'm about a year sober, and I'm sitting around feeling really sorry for myself, and I get a phone call from this corpsman. I hadn't seen him for a while. He says, hey, Mick, what are you doing? It's Friday night. And I said, well, I'm not doing anything at all. I'm thinking about drinking, but I didn't tell him that. And he said, well, why don't we go out to PB, go over to Pacific Beach tonight? And I said, okay, sounds like a plan. So I meet, because I, lost my driver's license, hadn't quite gotten it back by then. I go downstairs to meet him from the barracks. He picks me up, and we're heading down Pacific Beach, and we're going down Grand Avenue. Most of you are probably familiar with it. And all of a sudden, we're getting real close to Cass Street. And I'm starting to sweat, because that's where the plush toad is, the Ilano Club. I did not want to go to the Ilano Club. Thank God he turned left instead of right on Cass. And my first thought is, ooh, there's a great, great club down the down this road a little way. We can have some serious fun, do some partying. So what happened is he goes one block down to Thomas Street and turns left again. And he pulls up in front of a church. And I looked at him and said, okay, Doc, what's going on? Did you get religion? And he just laughed a little bit. He said, no, Mick. He said, look, about a year ago, I went through this Navy treatment center up in Long Beach. And this is a young people's AA meeting. It's Friday night, young people in Pacific Beach. And he said, you might benefit from going. That's the second time that man saved my life. That became my home group for the next 6 years until I moved. And I don't know if Doc made it or not. He got transferred, left the area, and I never heard from him again, which was sad because he was a great guy. But I know this, twice he saved my life. And I'm internally grateful for that. And then I started taking the steps a little more seriously. I struggled with the notion of gratitude. I'd hear people say, I'm a grateful alcoholic. It's like, no, you're a nut. And I was at this retreat, and they were playing music really loud. And I mentioned to Mark earlier, I don't do well with loud noises. I spent too many years on rifle ranges and whatnot, and near jet engines and the whole thing. So they start this song off, It's supposed to help you get in touch with your feelings. No, thank you. Not really interested in that deal. And song starts off and says, "Why me, Lord?" Well, I was still very good at taking other people's inventory. And I took his. And I started off, "I'll tell you why you. You're a long-haired, no-good, hippie, SOB, rah, 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 rah." And it goes on to say, "What have I ever done?" Nothing, because you're a long-haired, hippie, no-good, SOB, rah, 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 rah. "To deserve even one of the kindness you've shown." And all of a sudden, there's tears just flowing off my face. I was 21 years old, and I was sober a year. I had never done anything to deserve that. I hear people at meetings, I call it AA chic speak. There's a lot of cool little expressions. "I earned my seat at AA." Oh, good, I'm so impressed. I did not. My seat was a gift. And I get to keep the gift by doing the deal. That's the only way I know how to keep my gift of sobriety. So I'm sitting there getting in touch with some really unpleasant experiences and feelings. And it kind of shook me to the core. But I still struggle with the notion of any kind of a higher power. So Jim said, "Why don't you do this? Go down to the beach and make the waves go backwards." So I can do that, or at least try it. So I did. I went down to the beach, and I ordered those waves to go backwards instead of come in. And that didn't happen. Apparently, the waves didn't care what I thought. Clearly, there is a power greater than myself. Sandy B., a guy I knew on the East Coast years ago, used to joke about that. He said, "You know, it's a higher power, and it ain't you." Yeah, Sandy B., yeah. Sandy B., I knew Sandy, yeah. He's a good guy. Sandy. Did you? Yeah. So, anyway, Sandy used to joke about that, and I like that joke. That, by the way, I know there's a lot of people that are far more into the spiritual side of life and whatever, recovery, and I'm happy for them. But that is the extent of my intellectual inquiry into a higher power. There is one, and I'm not it. I don't care how it's defined, by whom it's defined, whatever, doesn't matter. So then I'm talking with Jim, my sponsor. By the way, in 52 years of sobriety, I've had exactly 3 sponsors. I believe in continuity in sobriety. I've only changed sponsors because they die. It's getting very hard to find somebody that's willing to sign up for the duty at this point. But Jim and I were talking about this, and I said, "How do I do a fourth step? How do I identify all of these moral failings, whatever?" And he said, "I want you to pull out your notebook, your first step. Let's go through some of it." I hate thieves with a passion. And I stole money, and I stole booze, and I stole drugs. I was a thief. And I hated that about me. I lied to people. I lied about having fun. I lied about, anything and everything you could imagine. I lied about it, even when there was no real reason to. It had just become part of my survival mechanism that I was using. So when it came time, I used that fourth step, the written fourth step, to do a written fifth step and write it out very clearly. What were those moral failings of mine? And they were big and ugly. And I will tell you, I had never felt so bad about myself in sobriety as I did that moment. And when I went to talk to Jim about it and to share my fifth step with Jim, what I discovered was I never had to feel that way again, because I would never do those things again if I stayed sober. And he was right. It was rather amazing how that worked. So then we started talking about some of the other things. We got to the eighth step. You know, make a list of all the people you had harmed. Well, there was no way I could identify the cops that I'd given grief to, or I suppose if I'd have pulled out some police reports, I might have found a couple of them, but, you know, by then I was in a different state, so I didn't. So I make out this list of all the people, my family members, you know, my mother. My dad died when I was 7, so he was kind of out of the picture. That's why I was a rumpled childhood. My mother and my uncles and all these people that I'd hurt, the women that I'd dated and dumped and whatever, rudely. And what ended up happening it was this rather long and arduous process. And he said, okay, you got to get started on the ninth step. Well, not everybody is receptive to a ninth step. My mother was drunk. I shouldn't have tried to make amends to her when she was drunk. On the other hand, I'd never seen her sober in the last 20 years. So I left her a big book and I left. It didn't take, unfortunately. I went to my sisters. I have three sisters, really wonderful human beings that suffered greatly because of my mother's alcoholism and because of my bad behavior. And I was able to make amends to them all. Took time. And I was feeling pretty good, and I was making amends where I was, and living amends with police and with the Marine Corps. I spent my last 4 years in the Marine Corps sober. And I was getting ready to go back to Minneapolis for a business trip. And my sponsor, Jim, called me up, because I had told him I was going. And Jim called me up and said, hey, don't you have some amends to make in Minnesota? I swear to God, this guy had a memory like an Al-Anon. Jesus. I hated this uncle with a passion. And he said, it says you have to be willing to make amends, except when to do so would injure them or others. He doesn't have to accept it, but you have to be willing to try. So I'm looking for the easier, softer way, because, you know, that's what I did. And I called him up at his office. And I said, hey, you know, Uncle Dick, can I swing by your office at lunchtime? I want to chat for a few minutes. And I'll tell you what, come to the house for dinner tonight. Oh, God. Okay, I'll do that. Now, I should tell you that by this point, my sister and six of his kids had moved out. So there's only going to be, you know, the eight of us and a small family gathering. But then it occurred to me, I had done my magic, as it were, my bad behavior, in front of those cousins and my aunt, too. I owed them all amends to the best of my ability. So I got there, and we're having dinner, and we're just, you know, kind of marginal talk, nothing any very exciting. And I said to my uncle, I said, I want to tell you why I'm here tonight. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober for however long it had been at the time. And I'm coming to apologize. You and your family went out of their way to give me a home when I didn't have one, to try and help me when I was in desperate need of help. And all I can say is I wasn't worthy of what you tried to do. I didn't appreciate it then, and I do so very much now, and I'm grateful. And I thought, he was looking at me funny. I thought, oh, crap, we're going to have another fist fight. And he looked at me for about a minute. I mean, it was just, you know, that uncomfortable silence, like when a leader of a meeting says, who would like to share? That uncomfortable silence, nobody talks. That's kind of what happened here. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, this can't be good. And he looks at me, he said, you know, I've been thinking I need to come out to the West Coast and look you up. He says, I think I was 6 years sober at the time. He said, I've been sober for 8 years, and I want to make amends to you. He got sober about a month after I left his house. Now, I would love to say it was all, you know, honey and milk and, you know, unicorn farts or something. It really wasn't. But we got along after that. We were able to have some family time together. He and I were never particularly close, but we were able to mend those fences, make those amends. Best feeling I ever had. And as I've come across others that I owed amends to that I didn't even know I owed amends to, I made amends to them too. There's such a relief in that ninth step. I want to talk briefly because I'm probably going to run out of time if I know. I have some pet peeves in AA. Now, I want to say, our program of recovery is located right in that blue book right there, the one titled Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything you need to know about the program of AA is in that book. What you hear from the podium from people like me or others is our interpretation of the book or how we practice it or whatever. I've always gotten a kick out of where, you know, reading in chapter 5, you know, we practice these principles in all our affairs. I'm married. My wife won't let me have affairs to practice in. But other than that, I'm pretty good about that stuff. So whatever I'm going to share is just my opinion, and you're free to laugh at it or throw it out or whatever you'd like to do. Number one, There was a sign last time I was at the Plush Toad in PB. It said, think, 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 but somebody had turned it upside down. Now, the history of that is Dr. Paul, funny guy that he was, wrote a piece just kind of as a joke called The 20 Questions of Thinking. And it was a parody of The 20 Questions of Drinking. Do you crave a think at a certain time every day? Has thinking caused you trouble? Do you think alone? I mean, it was hysterical. And people have adopted that like it was some kind of gospel, like, my God, I'm in AA, I'm not allowed to think. Baloney. I can't imagine not thinking about my recovery, what I want out of it, where I'm going with it, how I'm sharing it. It's my recovery. But there you have it. And there's another one. I love this one. I was up in L.A. speaking not long ago at a meeting, and one of the characters that was sharing came out and said, what you think of me is none of my business. It's a very dramatic Hollywood kind of thing. What a load of crap. I'll tell you what, if you don't believe what your friends tell you, you need new friends. Because if I grade my own report card, I get an awful lot of A's. I may not have even taken the test, but I'm going to get the A. So I have surrounded myself over the years of my recovery with people whose opinions I respect so that they can come to me and say, Mick, I'm worried about you because this is what I see. And they can share that with me knowing that I want them to because their opinion does matter to me. Now, they may be wrong. They may not have all the facts. But by golly, I have friends that I trust enough that they're going to do their best to try and help me by sharing with me. And I love that about my friends. I really do. My home group, by the way, is Tuesday night up at used to be at Scripps Clinic, and now we're located at a church in right on the border of Del Mar and Solana Beach. I'm giving one of my friends a 51-year token on a week from Tuesday, another guy a 46 next Tuesday. That meeting has been my home group for 46 years. I like stability in my recovery. I like the fact that in my home group, there are four of us that have over 50 years of sobriety. And people say, why do you keep going to meetings? Because I find it invigorating to hear how other people approach their recovery. Yeah, I'm opinionated, but I'm always willing to change my opinion if somebody says something that makes more sense to me. That's part of being an adult. When I first got sober in 1973, there was a gas war. Some of you probably remember. OPEC had decided to turn off the valve, and you had to wait to get to a gas pump. If you had a car like I did with a license plate that ended in an odd number, it was, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. And if you had an even number, it was Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And Sunday, I guess, was a free-for-all if they had any gas. And I had all the patience of a constipated alligator because I was 21 years old. And I'd get in line trying to get to the gas pump and not, do what I was trained to do. And so what ended up happening is I bought a little book. I haven't seen it here tonight. I'm sure it's somewhere, though. It's called As Bill Sees It. I love that book. And I still have the one I bought, and I still read it. And it would say, you got it back there? I'd read it maybe a page or two and move a car length forward. And I wasn't upset anymore. And some of the things that really stood out for me was there was this thing where it said, we must return to the world that we rejected. And I like that. I had stopped being a family member. I had stopped being a member of society in any productive manner. I had to return to the world I had rejected. I blame them for rejecting me, but who the hell wouldn't? I was crazy. I would have rejected me, too, if I could have remembered who I was. To share a little story I want to share. There's I don't know how many Marines are here tonight, or maybe there's some FMF Corman here. We have a hill up at Camp Pendleton. It's called Mount MF. That does not stand for Mighty Fun, by the way. And you hike from the battalion area, full combat gear, so you got about 50, 60 pounds of junk on, and you hike to the base of the hill. It's about 10 miles. And then you go up the hill, and it is long and steep and ugly. And it was in the middle of summer, August, when I went up, and it was hot as hell and dusty, and I was like the fifth or sixth guy, maybe seventh guy, to get to the top of that hill. And I was so very proud of that fact. I beat all those younger guys who were older than me, supposed to be stronger, tougher, whatever. I beat them to the top of the hill. I was pretty darn proud. And I took off my pack and my helmet, and I laid down my rifle across my pack, and our platoon sergeant said, "All right, ladies, get your packs and helmets back on, grab your weapons. You are going back down the hill. You're going to find somebody who's in trouble, and you're going to walk with them. Show them how you got to the top of the hill. Encourage them." Now, there are a couple of people that would go down and they'd find somebody, "What's the matter with you, you lazy SRR," and really rip into them. I didn't find that motivating at all. Not in the least. I went down and found a guy that was struggling, and I said, "Let's do this. You can look to the top of the mountain to see where you're going. Nothing wrong with that. But what you need to concentrate on is the next step that's right in front of you. And every now and then you look up, see where you're going, make sure you're on the right path, but you put one foot in front of the other, one step at a time. We'll get you to where you want to be." And that guy and I got to the top of the hill. And he thanked me, which was kind of nice. And the reason I bring that story to you is because that's our 12th step. I've been around AA meetings where people are rude, especially to newcomers. I never really understood that. They're afraid of the people that have relapsed. They don't want to go near them. When I was, they call them the druggy buggies. I don't know if you have those here. The druggy buggies were these god-awful white vans that U.S. Navy, and from the treatment center, off we'd go to a treatment, to an AA meeting someplace. It's great. And they used to take us to this one meeting in Poway. Now, this is back before Poway got all she-she, and it was all a bunch of cowboys up there, And I walked into this meeting. I had a watch on. And this guy came up to me, and he was an old-timer. He had to have 2 or 3 years of sobriety. And he was kind of old. He's 35, 40 years old, something like that. And he looked at me and said, "Boy, I spilt more than you ever drank." "Well, maybe if you hadn't been such a goddamn slob, you'd have gotten here as young as I did." That, by the way, did not endear me to that group. I thought it was funny as hell. They didn't seem to think it was funny. The next week we were there, and he noticed my watch again. And it was a very nice watch. It wasn't one of my really valuable watches. I had a watch collection until my house got robbed anyway. And it was a very nice watch. And he said, "You know, boy, you got a watch. You haven't hurt enough. You need to go drink some more." And I was livid. So I went back and I found Jim the next day and I said, "This guy said I have to drink because I own a watch." And I looked at Jim and he thought about it. Jim was funny about this. He just think about it for a minute. He said, "I'm really busy this week, but I think there's something about watches in the big book. Why don't you read the big book and remind me where it is?" Spoiler alert, if you have not read the big book yet, there are no stories about watches. And I wasn't sure if I was madder at the guy or madder at Jim at that point. But Jim used to remind me that the whole idea of our book is so we can read it and learn. That's what it's there for. I thought, okay. So if you own a watch, you don't have to go drink. In fact, if somebody tells you you should go drink, there's a real good chance they have some deep-seated psychological problem. Run like hell, because they got no business telling you that at an AA meeting. Kind of finish off here a few minutes earlier than I guess I'm supposed to, but I will anyway, with this last tidbit. I was talking to some young guys at a, they were at a sober living home. And they'd had an AA meeting and whatever, and afterwards we were talking. And as we spoke, they're all outside lighting up cigarettes, swearing like a bunch of drunken sailors. And one of them got in a car and tore down the street. It was in a family neighborhood. And so, type in Cold Wars. Mickey Mouse, but my ears are smaller, you know. So is my bank account, damn it. Tore off down the street in his car like just a bat out of hell. And I talked to the guy that was had been the secretary of the meeting. I said, has somebody talked to this guy? Hey, man, he's sober. F you. He's sober. So what? That's not good enough. We have to return to the world we rejected. That's what Bill Wilson taught, and I believe it. To that end, I am absolutely confident. Of all the things I've said here tonight, I can assure you of this. I am the only big book anybody will ever read outside of an AA meeting. And how I act out there, that reflects on AA. And if I act like that kid did, F you, I'm sober, that's good enough. We have to remember that our program is one of attraction rather than promotion. And if you're not going to be attractive in the way you behave out in public, in your affairs, you're not representing AA well. And you may be depriving somebody of an opportunity to get sober. I like to live my life to the best of my ability, with the notion being that as the big book that they're going to read out there, and I will tell you, I'm the least anonymous soul I know. I don't go on public TV or radio or any of that stuff, but and I'll explain briefly why. But the reality is, most everybody that meets me knows that I'm affiliated with AA in some capacity. And I want them, when they read this big book, to come to me and say, Mick, I've got a father or a wife or a husband or a cousin, a sibling. Would you be willing to talk to them? And the answer is always yes, I would be. Because that's what we have to do. Now people say, well, you have to wait till they hit bottom. Where in the hell in the big book does it say we don't reach out? Because we got a whole chapter of working with others. We got a 12 step that says we carry the message. The responsibility is theirs. I walked up that hill with that kid. He carried his own pack because I have my pack to carry. All of you have your own pack to carry, and you will get to the top of the hill, and you can help somebody else get there, but you'll never be able to carry their pack, because if you do, they'll never get to the top of the hill. You are a wonderful group, and I'm so happy to be back here. Last time I spoke here, I think it was 50 years ago. Obviously, you can see I made a great impression then. But I do appreciate your attention tonight. Thank you so much.
I would like to thank Mick for coming here tonight, and we hope you come back soon. Let's give Mick another hand.